From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about local lesbian history in honor of Lesbian Visibility Week. Then, we'll learn about a new program that's donating birding backpacks to community centers across Milwaukee and Madison.
In order to get communities that have typically been excluded from the outdoors and outdoor activities like birding in Wisconsin, you have to start by meeting people where they're at and go to them.
We'll speak with the director of Light Needs, a film about plants.
The film let me explore a lot of different attitudes people have towards houseplants or plants that they share domestic or, in some cases, office or workspaces with, and that became more of the pursuit.
Plus, we'll have the latest episode of Live at Lake Effect featuring Milwaukee's own Buffalo Nichols. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. It's Lesbian Visibility Week. It aims to both celebrate lesbians and show solidarity with all women and non-binary people within the LGBTQ community. While it's marked nationally, one Wisconsin organization wanted to do more to celebrate locally. The Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project's mission is to reconnect Wisconsinites with our hidden queer history with a focus on education. To celebrate Lesbian Visibility Week, they've created a free lesbian history exhibit as well as other events. To learn more about some local lesbian history, I'm joined by Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project board member Nicole Kurth. Nicole, welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we're speaking during Lesbian Visibility Week, which originated in 1990. And while this is marked nationally, why did you want to mark local history? And what are some of the things that you're doing to celebrate Visibility Week?
So one of our advisors, Stephanie, brought to our attention that there was no local LGBTQ organization that was sponsoring Lesbian Visibility Week. And we discussed it as a board and we said, yeah, this is an important event and we definitely want to mark its occasion. So we got together and through Stephanie's partnership, we are working with the national organization, which is the Curve Foundation, to bring these events and make sure they're accessible to all.
And with accessibility of events, there's stuff happening kind of throughout different locations in the city. What are some of the highlights?
So some of the highlights are of the Women's History Celebration. We'd love to see you all out on Saturday, April 27th, with a good old-fashioned lesbian potluck at the community center. Also, check out our events online. We'll have films highlighted, webinars, and a lesbian history exhibit at the City Hall Rotunda. Also excited that we'll have the flag flying and the courthouse will be illuminated along with the City Hall in lesbian pride colors.
So you mentioned this lesbian history exhibit at City Hall. So I'd love to dive into some local lesbian history. And let's start with Annie Hindle, starting way back in 1884. Who was she?
So Annie Hindle was actually the first internationally famous drag queen who happened to come to the Milwaukee Dime Museum in November of 1884. And when Annie made their appearance in the city, the local newspapers didn't really know what to make of her. She was reported as an ill-mannered male impersonator who happened to marry not only two women, but a man in three separate church weddings. So they decided that she was probably a man deceiving audiences all along. It's just she wasn't, but that's how they were reporting it back then.
Yeah, don't know what to make of it, so let's make a broad generalization.
Exactly. History doesn't always get it right.
Yeah. Well, and one of the challenges of history is trying to decipher clues from what's reported from this outside perspective. So let's dive into when there's a first mention of a first lesbian hangout here in Milwaukee. Where and when was that?
So we're in 1928 now, and we're at an establishment known as the St. Charles Hotel. And if you're familiar and unfamiliar with that, it was actually located across the street from the Milwaukee City Hall. And this one's interesting because it actually was raided by the FBI. When you look at their notes, they described it that fairy boys and bulldaggers were roaming the halls in search of gin parties, as well as chorus girls who may have not been girls after all. The lobby bar in the hotel was a half block long, and it often was packed with women from the Orpheum traveling circuit who were looking to hook up with other women. The St. Charles was so decadent that it was padlocked for an entire year by prohibition agents. So it was pretty scandalous.
Yeah, the scandal and the raids seem to be the things in the papers, especially centuries ago, right? And we touched a bit upon it, but the challenges of trying to collect and preserve LGBTQ history and what this organization does is that it's a challenge, right? So what are some of the reasons that we honestly just don't know much about mid-century women's spots and other things about lesbian culture?
Well, it has to do with, you know, feeling safe. Safety has a lot to do with it, or not trusting if they don't know who you are. A good example of that is the Fin and Feather or the Wildwood. They didn't advertise to outsiders because they were suspicious of them, and they really fiercely defended their turf. But they were great spaces that supported women, especially when looking at women's sports teams, which includes softball in the summer and bowling in the winter. And these were also noted to have spaces for women to dance together, which wasn't, you know, always available in other spaces. And there was a very colorful history, especially at the Wildwood. So Josie Carter, who is a longtime contributor to our project, she told us a tale one night that there was these Amazon women, she called them, and they were a group of big diesel women who did not tolerate toxic masculinity. And one night, a drunk male stumbled into the bar and he started hassling a black patron in the bar. And one of the Amazons walked up to her and said, "Is he bothering you?" But she was too afraid to say yes. And the man kind of shot off his mouth and he said, "What are you going to do about it?" And called her a choice name. And she just wasn't going to have that. So she walked into the bathroom, took the toilet tank cover off of the toilet seat, and came back out and cracked him over the head with it. And the whole bar erupted in cheers. And it was just another night at the Wildwood.
Yeah, just another night can, I'm sure, be used as a phrase for a lot of bars in Milwaukee history here. And obviously, gathering spaces are really important to LGBTQ history, especially lesbian history. And one of those places was called Stan's Nightbeat on 9th and National. Can you share a bit of Stan's Nightbeat's backstory?
So Stan's Nightbeat originally opened in 1959, and it was opened by a heterosexual couple named Stan and Carrie. And they deliberately opened a lesbian bar, and it became the hottest spot to be for the next 13 years. It was definitely a butch bar. So there was roles of butch and femme at this time because it was 65 years ago. And there was no either or. You had to make a choice. You were either in the butch camp or the femme camp. They later moved to 2nd and Pittsburgh, and it became an anchor point in the gay village by the end of the 60s.
Well, and, you know, all these stories aren't just about wild and raucous and fight-filled nights, of course, and there's a big role that bar owners play. So I want to talk about Sharon Dixon. She worked at a couple of local gay bars before deciding to open her own, which was called the Sugar Shack.
Yeah, so Sharon Dixon actually was known to work at two bars in particular. One was called the Leaded Shade, and the other one was the River Queen. Those spaces inspired her to open up her own bar, which was a open space for women owned by women. And that's important to note because a lot of these bars back then were owned by straight couples, but they exploited the gay community because the gay dollars weren't going back into the community. So she wanted to change that. She opened up a bar with her partner, Joanne, and the Sugar Shack was on 135 East National in 1975. And it became very well known around the Midwest. People would travel here because they found out it was owned by the community and they wanted to contribute to supporting the bar. They did also defend their territory there when necessary. There's a tale that we uncovered while doing some research that two men came into the bar and they were causing trouble. And Sharon said, "You need to leave." And they refused. And so she got on the microphone in the bar and informed all the patrons, "Hey, we're no longer serving until these two guys leave." And they found a way to motivate those two men to leave very quickly. And in fact, one of them left so quickly that he dropped his wallet, which they had to call the police for. And they turned the wallet over. And when the police officer opened the wallet and looked at the ID, he noted that it belonged to the son of a police officer. So the women went back to partying that night, and I'm assuming that that son maybe got an earful from their dad later that night.
Well, and you know, highlights the importance of safe spaces and owners who back up their patrons, right?
Exactly. And Sharon's adventures in bar ownership did not end there. Eventually, she split up with her partner, and she ended up opening a new bar on 15th and Scott. And that one is pretty well known to this day. It was called Kathy's Nut Hut, and it operated from 1980 to 2014. And for years, it threw something called Fanny's Fest, which was a longtime lesbian institution, Fanny's. And it was a grassroots street fair. They helped raise money for the AIDS crisis, which is important to note. Sharon is no longer a bar owner. She's retired from it. But she was very, very involved in a lot of the work years ago.
So people like Sharon and the institutions they championed aren't here today, but Sharon is one of the people highlighted in the history exhibit that we talked about earlier. But if people aren't able to go to City Hall in person or see the courthouse or other things like that during Lesbian Visibility Week, how can they get connected to this local history?
We recently launched a new website. It's updated. So if you have never visited our website or haven't seen it in a while, it's very informative, has lots of pictures to look at. There's podcasts and all kinds of things you can look at there. Also, you can follow us on social media such as Facebook, Instagram, or even LinkedIn. And please note that we might be coming to a Pride Festival near you this summer. So we are launching in commemoration of our 30th anniversary this June. We'll be traveling around Wisconsin on our Summer to Be Seen tour. So look for us with our pop-up history exhibits. We'd love to talk to you, hear your stories. And if you have any recommendations of folks that you would like us to interview, or even if you want us to interview you, let us know, because we love discovering new history and hearing your stories, because it's what it's all about.
Nicole Kerth is the Pride Center Coordinator at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay and a board member of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project. You can find out more information about Lesbian Visibility Week and the local events around it at WUWM.com. I am a volunteer community advisor for the History Project. This week, we're celebrating Earth Day by exploring different ways our community is making the outdoors more accessible. The BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin recently donated 20 birding kit backpacks to neighborhood centers and schools across Madison and Milwaukee. The new program aims to make it easier for people who have historically been excluded from accessing nature and the outdoors to get started with birding. To learn about the initiative, Lake Effect's Excrent Nunez is joined by Jeff Galligan, the co-founder of the BIPOC Birding Club, and the Wisconsin Birdathon coordinator, Somi Gadamidi.
Jeff, I want to start with you and ask, how did you get this idea to start this project?
Well, I've always been looking for ways to connect with neighborhood centers and schools and things like that to help bring birding to children in the Madison and Milwaukee area. But a couple of years ago, the Feminist Bird Club Wisconsin chapter did a backpack kit campaign with Madison Public Libraries. And I thought that was a great idea. And they've had really good usage. And that was my end to try to connect with centers and people serving kids and families. You know, we definitely put our own twist on it and things like that, but use the same rough principle as well. The idea is to get a child and a parent or trusted adult out birding. Maybe that doesn't have typical access to that and the equipment needed.
Somi, you're the coordinator of the Wisconsin Birdathon. Tell me a bit about the role this fundraiser played in making this project happen.
Sure. Yeah, the Great Wisconsin Birdathon is a peer-to-peer fundraiser for bird conservation here locally in the state. and it works kind of like a walkathon fundraiser, but instead of logging miles walked, people are logging how many bird species they see and raising funds for bird conservation projects from their family and friends. So the Birdathon supports the Natural Resources Foundation's Bird Protection Fund, which chooses some high priority bird conservation projects, such as restoring habitat, monitoring bird populations, and also education and outreach. And then kind of a unique feature of the Birdathon is that nonprofits, bird clubs, and Wisconsin bird cities are able to keep half of their team's funds raised for their own local projects to support bird conservation and environmental education. So they kind of split their team's funds 50-50 with the Bird Protection Fund, doing kind of larger scale projects, and with local smaller scale projects that have a really big impact at both levels. And so we're really glad that the BIPOC Birding Club and the Feminist Bird Club in the past have been able to use those funds to support birding backpack kits.
No, definitely. And I was going to ask Jeff or Somi, how long in the making has this project been?
It really was last year that I, about this time, that I started to really hone in on it and start planning, really planning and preparing. The bulk of the work was done at around the turn of the year, January, February. We created a guide that has parks near each of our donation sites and what birds people could expect to see at a different, in any season in the year. So that took a while to do.
Definitely. And I know, Jeff, the BIPOC Birding Club aims to create a safe space for people of color to enjoy birding and the great outdoors. But how does this backpack project tie into the club's mission?
Well, I think in order to get communities that have typically been excluded from the outdoors and outdoor activities like birding in Wisconsin, you have to start by meeting people where they're at and go to them. You can't necessarily just expect people to come your way. And that's what we're trying to do. This is a way to just at least expose, you know. I think it's all about exposure. Everybody doesn't have to become a rabid birder or anything like that, but just a way for people to spend some quality time together while noticing and appreciating what's going on around them in a natural area. I think that's really important, not just because they're together, but just being in that environment is very healthy for one's mental health and well-being.
Right. And something you mentioned earlier, you mentioned that there's a birding backpack guide. What else is included in each of these backpacks?
That's great. Thanks for pointing that out. We have, with our partners, Knox Provisions, they have donated a set of children's and adults' binoculars for each of the 20 backpacks. They've been a staunch supporter of us, which has been amazing. We have a Sibley's East field guide included, and we have a field guide for kids in Spanish and English, courtesy of the Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance. And then, as you said, the guide that we created specifically for the centers, schools that we're donating kits to.
That's really great. And where can people go check out these backpacks and use them for themselves?
Well, we are donating to 10 in Madison right now. We have Vero Court Neighborhood Center, Bayview Foundation, Goodman Community Center, Elver Park Neighborhood Center, East Madison Community Center, Meadowood Neighborhood Center, Kennedy Heights Community Center, Neighborhood House Community Center, Lucier Community Education Center, and Forest Edge Elementary School.
Wow. And do you know about where they might be found in Milwaukee area?
Yes, we do have some right now. Neighborhood House of Milwaukee, a Family Engagement Collaborative Sites of Northwest Catholic School, St. Margaret Mary Catholic School, and St. Catherine. And Rita Flores-Wiskowski, who is our Milwaukee coordinator, will be partnering with these sites to do some birding events and activities with children that attend those schools.
Just to clarify, are they free to use?
Yes, they are totally free. I think we'll leave it up to each entity how they want to do it. But typically, it's just kind of like checking it out for a specific period of time, much like a library book. I mean, you're checking it out, using it, and then returning it. So somebody else can have that opportunity as well. And you can use it more than once. I'm assuming people will be able to do that. I think that it'll be there, hopefully, in good shape for a long time.
Absolutely. And Somi, I also understand you became passionate about conservation and wildlife at a young age. Tell me a bit about when and why you first became interested in birding.
Sure, yeah. Well, I've always been passionate about the environment and kind of thought I was going to go to veterinary school. So I did an internship at the Wisconsin Humane Society in the Wildlife Rehab Center. And it was mostly working with baby birds, which I think I volunteered there specifically on only baby birds before that too. And I just learned so much in one summer, and then I would go out even outside of the internship and just be able to identify a bird species because I just held them so close. And it was really special, and I just kind of started naturally IDing birds just wherever I went because of that. And I felt really connected to them and just learned a lot more about bird conservation issues, and then kind of ended up working here and getting to coordinate the Birdathon, which is so fun to see other people make those connections too.
Yeah, no, it's really wonderful to hear how just like this small interest that you had in birds became into something that you really work with one-on-one. So what do you enjoy most about birding?
I think the people, actually. Like, I don't usually go out birding alone. I think I'm still not an expert by any means on identifying birds, but I think it's really fun to go out with a group and keep learning and just be able to share that experience instead of kind of just going on a hike and not noticing what's around you as much.
No, absolutely. And I, as my own experience, I totally agree. And I, as a new person to Wisconsin, I'm overwhelmed with happiness of like how welcoming the birding communities have been in like multiple spaces that I've been to. I feel like as a person of color, it was like tough for me to feel welcomed sometimes in like white dominated outdoor spaces. But when I've been on more outings and stuff, yeah, it's just been very encouraging and exciting for me to like start this new thing in my life, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome. I love going out with the BIPOC Birding Club, and it's so welcoming. And I didn't have too many other experiences going out birding before that. So I agree. I feel like it's just felt really welcoming in that space.
That's great to hear both of y'all say that, because that was exactly, you know, the mission, at least to start, to get people just feeling comfortable going in outdoor spaces and safe and around people that support them, celebrate their life for birds, first time seeing birds. And then from there, we've just been able to branch out and do other things.
Absolutely. And I do think that this project will create more of that access to especially younger birders too. And Somi, to wrap up, I want to ask, why do you think it's important to make birding an accessible activity for other young folks and their families?
I think connecting people to nature and birds at a young age is really important to get them interested and want to get involved in conservation, either as a career or just incorporating it into their everyday lives, is really important to just make those connections at a young age and have people see the value and importance of the environment. And I think birds are a great way to get people interested in some of those larger conservation issues.
Well, you know, Somi, you said that about as nicely as it could be said. I don't think I can add to that. That's exactly it. But I do say that, you know, if you see it, you can be it. So I think the more people of color that we get into outdoor careers and in conservation and environmentalism, things like that, or then it becomes really more of a reality for more people or a possibility. And I think that's really important for us to be working on that as well.
Jeff Galligan is the co-founder of the BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin. Somi Gadamidi is a young birder and the event and donor relations coordinator for the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. They spoke with Lake Effects expert Nunez for this week's Earth Day series. Tomorrow we'll hear from sisters who wrote a field guide on accessible walks in Milwaukee, places you can go without a car and trails that are accessible for people with disabilities. Coming up later in the show, Milwaukee's own Buffalo Nichols joins us to talk about his take on blues and folk music.
I'm just really trying to promote an open-mindedness for our audiences, and some people expect certain things, and I think everybody will be a lot happier if we kind of just let artists express themselves and not live up to any expectations.
But first, we'll tell you about a film that explores the relationship between people and their plants. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. What do we owe our houseplants besides light and water? It's a question that Milwaukee filmmaker Jesse McLean asks in a new experimental documentary, Light Needs. In it, she considers the relationships between people and the plants they live with, and shines a light on the responsibility humans have to care for other living things. WUWM's Lena Tran speaks with McLean about the film ahead of the screening at the Milwaukee Film Festival.
Where did this film project begin for you?
It began partly because I'm a lover of plants. I'm one of the people or a person that has, you know, 70 plus plants in my house. It's been a long time hobby, activity, obsession. And so it was personal. But I was thinking about plants in people's spaces, and I was really struck by a friend of mine who's also a plant person who was living in a kind of small apartment and had plants everywhere in his kitchen. The counter space was taken up with plants. There was not a lot of room to cut up vegetables, prepare food, and I thought, would I do that for my plants? Because when I asked him about it, he said, well, this is where they get the best light.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, am I that good to my plants that I would give up precious counter space for them? I should, because it gets the best light, but would I?
Yeah.
So that was kind of like sort of entry into like, what do we do for our plants? And even just thinking how on a certain level it's kind of odd that we do this at all, that we have plants inside. Like, it makes sense and it's so normalized, but there is this kind of moment where you think, like, why did we do this?
I understand that you worked on this for several years. So talk about what the filming looked like and, you know, what held your interest and kept you going for so long.
Yeah, it was longer than I anticipated, but I also didn't start thinking that I was going to make a feature film. I think I had initially just started thinking I would document the plants and the people, you know, who cares? And then that I realized that, you know, when the people would walk into frame, that was a lot more interesting. And I was kind of hoping they'd walk by and, you know, the plants would rustle in the wind or something like that. So part of it was like, okay, I got to dig deeper. I had been given the name of the two people that take care of the bonsai plants, Jack and Michelle, and I think when I met them and I went to their house numerous times to film and then we did an audio interview, and when I cut that scene together, I thought, okay, this is like a bigger film. I think this is a feature. So that was kind of, in a lot of ways, it was sort of accidental. I didn't start thinking I'm going to make a movie about people and houseplants. And then I just realized I had a lot of material and things kept happening.
And of course, I recognized UWM's campus. We go to the library, you meet the guy that's taking care of the plants at the library. Was much of this filmed in Milwaukee or southeastern Wisconsin? Are there any other things that Milwaukee viewers should be keeping an eye out for?
A lot of it was filmed in this area, in the, you know, Milwaukee County or just around Wisconsin. So the bonsai, so Jack and Michelle live in the Fox Point area, and they have a beautiful bonsai collection at Linden Sculpture Garden, which everybody should check out. And then, yeah, Jim Baxter at the UWM Library, of course. Interiorscapes is a local company that does plantscaping for businesses, and they have a monthly sale, which is how I knew about them, because I would go and, you know, get these amazing plants for really cheap prices, and it's open to the community. But, you know, most of the time, they're not open at all. And they were very generous to let me in and kind of tour their space and talk about what they do. And then a lot of other people's homes, because it is interested in domestic spaces. So there is one site that is in Chicago, but most
we'll
of
take it,
it. Yeah.
Yeah. At one point you asked this question where you're like, it's not should plants become more human by entering our space? It's can you become more like a plant? What are things that you think we could learn from plants or like that you think we might do well to emulate?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that comes from a kind of ideology or sort of ethics towards the non-human world, which is we always judge it on our own terms. Like a lot of times, all of the kind of vegetative world, be it plants outside or forests, we just kind of treat them like a backdrop for our own existence. And domesticated plants have a complicated history and that mm-hmm. you know, they didn't originate. Most of them come from pretty far away places around the world. So it's a complicated story. I mean, I think from a lot of things that are found in, you know, the natural world or the non-human world, just like stillness, patience, kind of viewing things on a different time scale. I mean, plants, things happen a lot slower for plants than we see. And I think as human beings, we're always kind of in a hurry to figure things out and get an answer and comprehend and just sort of, you know, I mean, everyone feels like they're in a hurry. Everyone feels like they're busy. Maybe plants, if they feel at all, maybe they are in a hurry too, but it seems like they're pretty good at a kind of slowness.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's this part where we get to eavesdrop on a plant conversation, which I really love. It's like this room, like a piano room, that's filled with plants, and they all talk to each other, and they express sorrow about being inside, and one of them wants to know what the wind feels like, and one wants to meet a bee. Did you imagine plant voices, like, throughout the project, or did the problems that they might face, like, did that come very easily to you?
I think pretty early on I realized, like, when I had sort of realized, okay, I'm making a feature and it's going to have different subjects, different attitudes, that I wanted the plants to, like, talk.
Yeah.
And I knew that they'd be voiced by human beings. And I kind of needed that to happen because even though at the beginning there's this text on screen that poses this question of what does photosynthesis feel like, and I can't really know because if I was to speak for the plant, it would be an act of ventriloquism. I knew that I was going to actually do that later, and I have had experiences with people where they're like, you said you weren't going to make the plant talk, and you did. But that's kind of the point, is I feel like I needed to acknowledge my own hand as like a human being making this film, and I didn't want to come off as some kind of plant expert or like, well, I really figured out, you know, how they feel. So I knew I wanted them to have a voice, but it would be, you know, complicated because you can tell that they're human beings. And in terms of what they talked about, I did kind of want them to have a kind of comedic but sorrowful conversation. You know, it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
And yet the things they talk about are pretty sad, about being kind of like left at someone's house or being sent through the mail and, you know, things that we do that we never think about, like, oh, that would be kind of traumatic if they have a consciousness.
Yeah.
But I also wanted it to end with them sort of theorizing in a kind of poignant and maybe a slightly melancholic way, like what some of these natural forces that they don't get to experience are like rain or wind,
mm-hmm.
you know, and yeah. they're kind of daydreaming about like maybe that would feel amazing or maybe it would be terrifying.
Well, so what do you hope that viewers, what do you hope that they get from that perspective?
A lot of people have told me that they think about their plants differently. They don't always follow that up like, now I'm nicer to my plants or, you know, whatever that means, or now I'm terrified of my plants because maybe they're listening to me. But just the fact that they think about them, like I pay more attention to them. And that to me is a really great outcome. You know, as I mentioned at the beginning, like I didn't shift, you know, I'm still this plant person that loves plants but forgets to water them. And it's a very humbling activity because even if you think you know a lot, you don't speak the plant's language and the plant could get sick and die. And you may think you're, you know, you've really got a handle on it, but there's a sort of mystery that will always be there. But I think just being attentive to them, like more than the obligatory, I need to water them, you know, mm-hmm. I need to change the soil every once in a while. I think just being like, oh, they're here, you know, and I don't know if they have a consciousness or how sentient they are, but like they're here and they're living. And I feel like in general, that's something that I'm interested in doing as an artist and as a person, is just sort of remembering and reminding ourselves like we're not the only species on the planet, you know, like there's so many other kinds of species and living beings that we coexist with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I definitely had that experience sitting out in the lobby waiting for you to come to the station. There were all these plants on top of the air conditioning vent, and, you know, they were all kind of like nodding in the AC output, and they're like, hello, Jesse, we're here, we're ready for you. So that was cool.
I was happy to see them.
Well, Jesse, thanks so much for coming to talk on Lake Effect about light needs.
Thanks so much for having me. And the leaves that
are green. Jesse McLean is the director of Light Needs. She spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. The documentary film screens today and Thursday at the Milwaukee Film Festival. You can find more information at WUWM.com. Milwaukee Film is a financial contributor to WUWM. We'll take one more break and then return with the latest episode of Live at Lake Effect featuring local blues musician Buffalo Nichols. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Leaves that are green turn to brown. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Live at Lake Effect is our music series featuring artists performing in the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood. We brought the Lake Effects together, along with Visionary Studios, to showcase local and nationally touring musicians. Today, we have Milwaukee's own singer, songwriter, and guitarist, Buffalo Nichols. He's played many different styles of music throughout his career, but today's Live at Lake Effect session highlights how he's taking traditional blues a step further. Here's Buffalo Nichols.
This song's called The Difference. It's about believing in yourself. When it came time to write your story, I was barely mentioned. Just a minor role, a place you'd go when you needed attention. But if I'm just a rest stop for your soul, I'll let it be. 'Cause I just don't know the difference between love and company. And the sun don't always shine on me, but I know that it's there, and it don't care if we live or die. Light is ours to share, and it's only you who's bleeding, but the pain is mine to bear. And I'm too weak to even speak or ask you to be fair. When it comes time to write my story, your own chapter. I'll tell the tale of how I fell and landed in disaster. And you can be the hero who comes to rescue me. 'Cause I just don't know the difference between love and sympathy. And the sun don't always shine on me, but I know that it's there, and it don't care if live or die, but the light is ours to share, and now both of us are bleeding, and the pain is mine to bear. And I'm too weak to even speak or ask you to be fair, and I never complained, but it didn't mean I wasn't of feeling pain. And I stayed in my place. I knew you were no good, but you'd be so hard to replace. Well, it must be time to end this story, for you have sprouted wings. I'll go back to my solitude. Go find better things. But if you should grow tired on the road that lies ahead, I hope you won't forget the one who kept your ego fed. And the sun don't always shine on me, but I know that it's there.
Hi, this is Audrey Nowakowski from Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. We're here at the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood for our music series, Live at Lake Effect. And today I'm happy to welcome singer, songwriter, and guitarist Buffalo Nichols. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thanks for the introduction.
What an amazing set you did. And you're here in Milwaukee and actually back home. You moved back from living in Texas and you were raised here. So yeah. To start, I'm curious about, what are some of your favorite core memories, or what is your Milwaukee?
Oh, yeah, so much. I mean, a lot of my life was spent just discovering the city and, you know, public transportation and driving. And I guess that's not specific to, to Milwaukee, but, you know, I really started to discover the city through the music scene, you know, started playing in different like bars on the north side, and then eventually got to see River West for the first time through the bars and, you know, playing in the venues. And I remember going to Mad Planet when it was still all ages.
For sure. Yeah.
In my early days. So.
And you played a bunch of different music growing up. And before we get into that, I want to start off with what sparked your interest on guitar, because that's where it started, right? Not necessarily blues. It was just the instrument.
Yeah, that's right. My older sister had a guitar and I just kind of picked it up out of boredom and started learning the songs that I heard on the radio. And that kind of just opened my mind up to guitar music, which is a lot of music. So I've been just chasing that thing ever since.
So what kind of music shaped you when you were first learning how to play? Were you just doing it by ear?
Yeah, I was doing it by ear. A lot of it was stuff on the radio, I guess. So I was learning some new metal songs and stuff like that, or trying to. And it was like the mix CD era. So my sister would give me CDs and like I would be playing Taking Back Sunday songs and stuff like that.
Yeah. Here's your curated playlist for you to practice. Uh-huh. And another thing that you learned really quickly early on was a portable sampler as well. We had an all acoustic set here today, but you do use this in your music and kind of change it up. What kind of role does it play for you? How do you enjoy the creativity it allows?
The thing that I've been dealing with lately is like these limitations of the guitar as an instrument, which is really more of a me thing than the instrument itself, but trying to just get outside of the world of vibrating metal and wood. So being able to make music with like the sounds that come from other places, like recording net found sounds and sampling other people's voices, just a totally different approach. And, you know, because the guitar can get frustrating because you're limited by your own technical ability. But with samplers, you can kind of just, whatever you hear, you can just turn it into music.
On the note of sampling and kind of changing it up, I have a feeling that you enjoy doing it not just for your personal creative benefit, but enjoy shaking it up for the listeners and changing the perspective of what people think the blues should sound like, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even the performance I've just done, I was on the way over here, I was thinking, what am I going to do? I even have my sampler in the car, and I just decided not to do it. And the live set that I do is totally different from what I've just done because it keeps it interesting for me, and I'm just really trying to promote like an open-mindedness for our audiences. And some people expect certain things, and I think everybody would be a lot happier if we kind of just let artists express themselves and not live up to any expectations.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And with pushing the limits of sound, you're using your instruments almost as a partner, like especially when I hear you on the steel and slides, like on some of your tracks on the album, it is your duet partner. So I'm curious with writing, does it come with you writing out lyrics first, or do you do a melody on the guitar and then things follow there?
Usually it starts with the instrument. Sometimes it'll be like one line that kind of inspires me to sit down and try to write a song. But usually I'm just playing a song and there's a melody, and then you just start saying gibberish and, you know, the syllables match up and then there's a word, and then you try to retroactively apply sense to it. You know, when you hear a song that means something, it's kind of disappointing to find out that it's really about nothing. But that's how it is sometimes. Songwriting is a mystery.
Yeah. Well, and part of your work in music is all about bringing the past into the future. Can you share a bit more about that and, you know, this mission that kind of shapes what you do?
Yeah. You know, I regret that I ever said that.
We could totally change it up. What would you your new mission statement to be right now?
Yeah, I gotta come up with a new one. I didn't know that I would need one, but apparently I do. But, you know, I kind of just got, like, people who know me from Milwaukee know that I did so many things, and Buffalo Nickels wasn't even a thing that anyone in Milwaukee knew about, but it just happened to be the thing that kind of worked in for me in the commercial music space. And I've been going along with it, but I kind of was just trying to, kind of like I was saying earlier, applying meaning to something that I was just kind of just, it was just like gibberish to me. Like I shouldn't say that, but I was playing blues because it was fun. And then people started to know me for it. So then I had to like explain why I'm doing it. And then because it's fun wasn't good enough. So I had to do all this stuff about bringing the past into the future. But that's really just like the way that I approach creativity is like, taking everything that I've learned and figuring out how to bring it forward.
Yeah. Well, I think it's totally acceptable to say you play blues because it's fun. We can keep it there for the record today. And with performing for audiences and as you said, following what intrigues you creatively, do you want to stay in this space or what are some projects or other genres that you're playing with that's not on stage right now?
Yeah, well, a lot of what I've been working on is kind of worked into my live show. And that's, I think, the people who come out to see me live get to see where I'm at creatively. And it changes constantly, probably too much for me to have a successful career. But I'm working on some things, and I'm going to make more of an effort to record and release that stuff. So this year, I think you'll see a lot more of that, more from the like experimental side and just, like I was saying before, using all types of sounds to express myself and not just the guitar.
You had spent some time living in Austin, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Moved there during the pandemic. Was that largely for your career? You mentioned the limitations of you need to stick to one thing to be successful in the music industry. How'd you find that experience and what brought you back home?
Yeah, I left for a lot of reasons. I had gotten to a point where I kind of switched over to music full time. So then once the pandemic hit, I couldn't really do that anymore. So I had to make that difficult choice. And there were a lot of opportunities for me in Texas. So I went there and I really decided to come back because I missed being in the Midwest, you know, culturally. I didn't realize how comfortable it was for me here, just the way that people are and communicate. And I really wanted to challenge the idea of like industry towns and how important they are, because I don't like the fact that people have to leave where they're from and go to Nashville or Austin to build a career. So I wanted to come back and see what it's like to just work where you're from. And it's really difficult, and I was wrong, and those people are right. So you should move to LA or something.
Well, and you are an amazing example of what Milwaukee has to offer. So having recently moved back, as you mentioned, finding it really difficult to make a living with music here, what does Milwaukee need to do to try and foster and support artists like you? What do you want to see change so that you can have the life you want here and not have to move?
That's a great question that I don't even have the answer to. I think a lot of it is, I guess the problem is so deeply rooted that it's hard to just give a straight answer. There's things politically and culturally that don't foster art. It's a, you know, we talk about it as like a blue collar kind of working class place, and that's because you just have to work so hard to survive. So it makes art and music seem like a luxury. So if we could get art and music to be just appreciated more, that would be the first step, I think, is to see it as a valuable thing in itself and then try to apply monetary value to that and support artists. And I think people are doing their best, but there are some greater external forces that just make it kind of difficult. So it's tough to answer.
No, that's totally fair. And with the current style you're in right now with blues, it's, I think, a great genre because lyrics and songs can be on the outside very simple, mm-hmm. but they're expressing either complex stories or thoughts. And to execute that well, that simplicity well, mm-hmm. it's tougher than people think. So how does this format and writing for blues challenge you in a fun way? Like, what do you like about writing lyrics for songs that are seemingly simple on the outside?
Yeah, that's definitely something that I think about a lot. And I go back and forth because, like, the songs that I played today are kind of wordy songs, because I do feel this kind of stereotype of the blues being, like, incredibly simplistic. And it can be in the, like, on the surface, like you're saying, but then the complexity comes from the emotions of it. So then it's kind of easy to put a lot of things into a song if you use a lot of words, but to try to limit that is the real challenge. And it's really all about, like, kind of being connected to your emotions and being an effective communicator and trying to get a point across in as few words as possible. Like, I just did that.
Did so well, though. I mean, like, the song, like, The Difference, you know, you're repeating a lovely guitar melody, but it makes you take a moment, take a beat, and listen to the lyrics as they change, mm-hmm. like, almost like poetry. That song, for me personally, that sucked me in, and when you deliver a simple yet line that punches you in the gut, you notice it.
Yeah, that's something that I've picked up from touring a lot. Is trying to get people's attention. I mean, usually people just go for sheer volume, but I think if you can try to just draw people in with the words, and sometimes even like a softer volume can force people to just really try to pay attention.
Yeah. Well, you certainly held our attention and more today. So, Buffalo, thank you so much for bringing your music and yourself to Live at Lake Effect.
Thank you so much.
That was Buffalo Nichols joining us for Live at Lake Effect. His latest album, The Fatalist, is out now. Be sure to head to WUWM.com and our YouTube page to see him performing 3 original acoustic songs in the Lake Effect Surf Shop. That video is done by Visionary Studios. Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep and myself are the executive producers of Live at Lake Effect. Sound engineering is done by WUWM's Jason Reavy. New episodes of Live at Lake Effect are released monthly, and be sure to check out our past episodes featuring the Lemon Twigs, Lola Kirk, Willie Porter, and more at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. And WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why Wisconsin is so important in this election year. You can find a trailer at WUWM.com. The first episode will drop next Wednesday, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at the status of real estate in the Milwaukee area in a time when demand is high with a low supply of housing. Join us tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm no more wise. We live to suffer.